welcome to the 25th edition of the Dr. Robbins Show. I'm Dr. Larry Robbins, here with my co-host Susie Robbins. I'm a neurologist and pain specialist and psychopharmacologist, and Susie Robbins, my wife, is a social worker. Each week we bring interesting hot new topics from the medical and health world, and we have a number of interesting stories that we want to get right into, so here we go. Now this week, Consumer Reports issued ratings on kids' cereals, and it was an eye-opener for me and for a lot of people. And what they concluded that was that a serving of 11 popular cereals, including Kellogg's Honey Smacks that we all have loved, carries as much sugar as a glazed donut, and we might as well eat a donut, actually. The most healthful brands turned out to be Cheerios, which had 3 grams of fiber per serving, and Kix, and Honey Nut Cheerios. It always seems that Honey Nut Cheerios should have more sugar, but it was actually more healthful than a lot of the others. And Life, good old Life cereal. Post-Golden Crisp, which is made by Kraft, and Kellogg's Honey Smacks are more than 50% sugar by weight, and it's the white refined sugar, which is not great for anything. Now, looking at the original Consumer Reports article, the very good cereals listed were Cheerios, Kix, Life, and Honey Nut Cheerios. And then good included most of them, such as Cookie Crisp and Lucky Charms and Cocoa Puffs. But fair, which are worse than fair, mediocre, were Cap'n Crunch and Rice Krispies. Rice Krispies is interesting. We always thought of it as maybe a little more healthful, but there was more sugar in it. Apple Jacks, Fruit Loops, Golden Crisp, these all have 10 times more sugar than the Cheerios or Kix. Now, it's interesting. They listed Honey Nut Cheerios as very good, but it looks like it has quite a bit more sugar than some of the others. So if we had to choose the healthiest sugar ones, it would probably be Cheerios, Kix, and Life. I think that cereal is fine. The problem I have with it is we don't get very much protein. It's a lot of sugar. It has some fiber and a fair amount of calories. And when they say a serving, a lot of people end up eating 3 servings. So they end up walking out with, including their milk, 500 calories to start the day, which is a hefty amount. Now over to my co-host, Susie. What do you think?
Well, it doesn't seem to be much of a surprise. I think most of us know that when we hear these Cocoa Crispy, Cocoa Pop type cereals, that we know that there's a lot of sugar in it. I'm thinking about kids in the morning who might have a bowl of one of these cereals, but then top it off also with a juice box and maybe a Pop-Tart, and that's really adding to the sugar. So I guess we have to think of the combination, too. If kids are going to have more than one thing, it has to be important to balance. If you are going to have a bowl of that more sugary cereal, then maybe something, say a piece of toast without all the butter and jam on it, might be something to kind of counteract it. You know, I can hear from so many people over the years, friends, family, who would say, you know, I started out trying to give my kids oatmeal or a cereal like Cheerios, and boy, you know, once they had a taste of the other cereals, we just could never go back. So I do feel for, and I do know there's a lot of frustration out there with parents. They want their child to have something for breakfast, and sometimes they end up giving them the sugary cereal because they know they'll eat it.
It's so funny that you say that, because how many times have we heard from well-meaning parents who have their first child, and before they have their first child, they say, my kid is not going to eat Count Chocula. They're going to eat organic whole grain, this and that. And of course, after their kid is 2 years old and there's another kid, you come in and of course they're having Count Chocula and Cap'n Crunch. You know, whatever the kid will eat. It's funny how that works. But you're right. You know, you send them out with sugary cereal, add in a Pop-Tart and juice box, and it is a whole lot of sugar. Now, you like your cereal in the morning. There's nothing better than eating cereal and reading the paper. What kind do you usually eat?
Well, I'm thinking to myself, because our home is definitely a cereal home in the morning. In fact, if the listeners would like to know, Dr. Robbins actually likes to have cereal, if he could, for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So some people don't mind having that bowl of cereal any time of the day. But I'm a Cheerios person. I think they're great, especially if you put a banana on top. And I know it gives me some energy for the next few hours.
Yeah, Cheerios turns out to be pretty good. I like the idea of these cereal bars or cereal restaurants. I think they're actually doing pretty well. I saw one in Manhattan recently that was filled to the brim with people. So they must like their cereal. I actually eat, when I'm being good about the diet, puff wheat and puff rice, which are half the calories per serving anyways of the most of the cereals. And you can get a lot of fiber. There's All Bran and various bran. You have to read labels to get the most, but All Bran probably has the most bran. As people get older, fiber is more and more important. Susie?
You know, and if you can't handle the All Bran because of the lack of taste of it, Raisin Bran is really good. You know, and you're getting those raisins, which, yes, is adding the natural sugar, but you're still getting all the bran.
Of course, it is important to read the labels. Some things will say that they're healthy or sound healthy, and you read the label and they don't have very much fiber and they're high sugar, so that's crucial. It takes longer to shop that way, but I think it's very important. Now, there was another story this week that was interesting about abuse of painkillers among teenagers, which I think is growing. And they looked at a lot of kids. 7% of U.S. adolescents have used prescription pain relievers that were not prescribed to them, which means they're getting them from their friends or from the street or stealing them from their parents' medicine cabinets, which is common. More than a third of these young people, which is 2% or more of adolescents, were dependent on the drugs. So they're really getting into a problem with opioids like Vicodin, OxyContin, Percodan, codeine, this sort of thing. And I think this signifies a shift a little bit in drug abuse, which we've seen in adults too, where alcohol is still number one, of course, but prescription drug abuse is gaining on everything. Now, the issue is, why do people abuse drugs? There's addiction versus dependence versus chemical coping. Now, addiction is continuing to use a drug despite bad things happening in your work life, social life, school life. So say your spouse is leaving you because of your alcohol and you're losing your job. That's addiction, where you can't control and can't stop it. Dependence, physical dependence, is often confused with addiction, but it's not addiction. People who take an opioid or a narcotic like codeine or Vicodin, if they're taking two a day or three a day, they become physically dependent on the medicine to some degree, where they'll have some withdrawal, but they're not necessarily addicted. Addiction is a set of behaviors also, using more and more, running around to a bunch of doctors, ordering it off the internet, that sort of thing. So with chronic pain, it's okay sometimes to be dependent but not addicted. And then there's the interesting category called chemical coping, where people cope with chemicals. And it turns out that this is common. Not all people who chemically cope are addicts. Say somebody takes one Vicodin a day for stress or anxiety and nothing bad is happening in their work or home life. Well, maybe it's not addiction. It's not great. We don't want to treat stress and anxiety with Vicodin or codeine, but it's not addiction. And it turns out that men probably cope chemically or chemically cope for different reasons than women. Men do it out of stress and anxiety, but also more out of boredom and thrill-seeking, and women tend to do it more primarily, it turns out, for depression and anxiety to relieve these. Now, this is nothing new. If you look at the old texts and newspapers from 1850 to 1870, 1880, it's interesting that the biggest problem, one of the biggest problems in the country, was people who were chemically coping with what was available at the time, which is morphine, opium-based medicines. They were usually elixirs or liquids, and they were doing the same. Now we're doing it with Vicodin, which is just another form of the same drug. So a lot of things never change. Now, Susie, as a social worker, you worked in a methadone maintenance place for adults with heroin addiction, and you also worked in a school with kids who had problems with drugs, whether it was smoking marijuana or other drugs. What do you think about adolescents and drug abuse, marijuana versus these pills?
Well, I think whether an adolescent is smoking marijuana on a regular basis or is taking some sort of prescription pills, I think you want to find out what is going on with that person that they're wanting to self-medicate. You know, are they depressed? Are they hanging out with people and trying to impress those people? And so they're going along with it. Are there things going on in their home that they're trying to escape? So I think for as many different people there are, you know, there will be lots of different reasons why a young person is doing it. So I think the first thing is to find out what is going on with that person and to be able to have that person trust you enough to be able to come in and start talking about it.
Now, would you do individual counseling for the adolescents or do groups work, you think?
Well, I think both would work, but my personal belief is that with someone, with a young person dealing with an issue like that, I think getting them in a one-on-one first would probably be most beneficial, and then certainly following up with group as well.
Now, looking at the psychological underpinnings of kids, it's probably a varied group. Some are just experimenting and relatively normal psychologically. Some have depression and anxiety. Some have bipolar depression. And then the worst category, but very important, is some are budding personality disorders, borderline personality or antisocial. And those are going to be, of course, a lot tougher to treat and to get at.
I agree. And I think there's usually there would be less of that category than most of the other categories that you mentioned in terms of the adolescents who I have seen. A lot of them, as you first mentioned, are within a group and there's a peer pressure feeling of having to keep up with other kids who are doing it for their own reasons. You know, and some kids are doing it as a way of escaping maybe what's going on in their own home, in their own life, and stresses that they are not able to deal with in a healthier way.
And with these pills, I wonder how many kids are just taking a Vicodin occasionally that somebody grabbed out of their parents' medicine cabinet, which is note to parents, keep your pills hidden, which is tough to do from kids. So occasional use of a Vicodin here and there, just like occasional experimentation versus becoming addicted or overusing or abusing, for instance, daily Vicodin. You know, they haven't looked into how much of that, but I think it does reflect the adults who are overusing pills much more than 20 years ago. The rate of addiction and overuse of opioid narcotics like Vicodin and OxyContin has grown exponentially in the last 10 to 20 years. Susie, what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, as we're talking about this, this is certainly not a new phenomenon that's happening. I don't know if any of our listeners out there can relate to this, but I can certainly remember going to high school dances in the 70s and seeing and knowing kids that were coming in after having gone through their parents' bathroom cabinets and taking some of the uppers from mom and dad's bottles and coming into the dances a little strung out.
You know, it's interesting. The drugs change. In those days, it was uppers, stimulants. They did have Valium around in the 70s, of course, but they didn't. The opioids weren't as prevalent, although codeine was around and some of the others. But they say about addiction, it's not so much the drug, it's the person. So when they've looked at rates of addiction to Vicodin versus codeine versus OxyContin, OxyContin has a very bad name, but actually the others are, people are just as likely to get addicted. It's really the person and not so much the drug.
Well, that says to me, have people really changed that much, or has there always been a need for a certain percentage of our population to want to self-medicate for feelings that they're having that they want to suppress?
You know, it's interesting. I think that if in a lot of things, nothing changes. I mentioned a few minutes ago that in the 1850s, there's a quote, actually, that the biggest problem in this country, this is from a doctor in 1850, the biggest problem in this country is middle-aged American housewives who are becoming addicted to morphine. And you could substitute Vicodin for morphine now, and it's the same now. But in other areas, it's interesting. There's a lot of heat on the drug companies for influencing doctors now. And reading an old article from 1894, they were talking about undue influence of doctors from the drug companies. Now, the drug companies weren't like the companies now. They mostly served up their patent elixirs and their potions. And in 1900, actually, aspirin had been newly invented a few years earlier by German organic chemists, and aspirin turned out to be a great drug. They had no idea how good a drug it would be, but it was more expensive in the United States, just like drugs are now. So people were smuggling aspirin in 1900 into the United States from Canada, and that ended when a bunch of fakes came in, like talcum powder. People started eating talcum powder, thinking it was aspirin. And sure enough, now we're having fake drugs coming flood into the country because of the high cost. So it's the same 108 years later. Now, there was an interesting study a few days ago about overweight children and headaches. We've known in adults that being overweight increases the risk of developing chronic daily headache. And now they've shown this in kids. They looked at 913 kids. And it turned out that the higher their body mass index and their weight, their increased risk for having chronic headaches. And then when they lost weight, they were maybe a little bit more likely to lose their headaches. And in the article, they speculated why weight may increase headaches. But we know that fat cells are not inert. They're not just sitting there doing nothing. The fat cells in your stomach are actually putting out compounds such as estrogen, more in women, but they're putting out inflammatory compounds that contribute to headaches and other things. They contribute to heart disease as well. So it's another reason to look at weight in kids. In earlier segment on this show, we talked about cereals for kids, which have more sugar. But I think that besides headaches, of course, increased weight in kids leads to a lot more high blood pressure. We're seeing high blood pressure in 18, 20-year-olds. Increased cholesterol, which is mostly genetic, but also weight and a whole bunch of other problems. So we don't want to harp on weight and get kids anorexic and crazy about weight, but childhood and adolescent obesity is a major problem. Susie, what do you think?
Well, you know, I can relate in being in middle age, and it's certainly harder to keep your weight. I'm not even talking about gaining weight, but just keeping the weight that you want to stay at. But as a child, if the child is obese, it seems to me it would be much harder than to stay at a healthy weight when you're older. So in terms of having a healthy weight as an adult, you're much better off being in a healthy weight as a child.
That's true. I think there's two aspects to that. One is the most important, which is behavioral, psychological. That you get into learned patterns of eating and decreased exercise as kids and adolescents, and you follow that into your 20s and 30s. And as kids get from age 10 to 15, they exercise less, and then when they go to college, they tend to exercise even less, so it's a challenge. But the other is when you develop that abdominal fat, those fat cells, they don't really go away. And old research, I'm not sure it's still held up, has indicated that those fat cells in your belly are tough to get rid of and lead to obesity later on. But I think it's more obese adolescents lead to obese adults for various reasons, mostly because they're still eating the same way and not exercising. Susie?
Well, we've heard in the media, in newspapers, et cetera, so much about how this generation of kids have become so addicted to video games and sitting around playing video games rather than going outside playing with friends in the neighborhood. One positive that I've heard involving video games in the last year, however, is this Wii game, where, yes, it is a video game, but it actually gets kids standing up and doing some sort of sport, whether it be tennis or golfing. So it's a little bit more interactive. You're actually moving your body. In fact, I recently saw on television where a Wii game has become the most popular recreational game at a nursing home for older people, too. It also is healthy for them. It's getting them up out of their chairs and moving around.
You know, that's a positive, the Wii game, at least more physical. But, you know, off the subject a little bit, I think the technology, there's a book out about technology in kids and adolescents about the computer, and it's very negative. It indicates that most of them are on networking sites like Facebook and MySpace, and they're playing games, and they're not really learning or care about politics and history and current events. They figure that they can just type in Wikipedia and get any history and geography. So it'd be interesting to see the average, say, high school senior's geography or history versus 45 or 50 years ago. And I think that looking at some recent surveys and studies, it's bad. There was recently one of geography in high schoolers where the high school kids were very poor in geography and also in history, where most of the kids had no idea what century the Civil War or World War II were in. Now, we'd have to go back to old surveys if they were done in 1950, say, and see. But I suspect it would be better. Maybe not great. Susie, what do you think?
My sister and I were actually having a conversation recently, and we were reminiscing about how when our dad would come home from work, he would bring home what was then a Chicago afternoon newspaper. I think it was actually called the Daily News. In any event, we would couldn't wait to get our hands on it, and we would argue over what sections we would each get first. And it seems today, now maybe some of the listeners out there have a different experience, but it seems that most young people these days aren't quite as interested in reading the newspaper and physically holding it, wanting to get it, because they can get anything that they want at their fingertips on their laptops.
And that would be okay if they were reading the newspapers online, which a lot of adults are. And newspaper readership, of course, is way down, and that has led to a whole shift in a lot of things, like less people sitting around in the morning eating cereal and reading the newspaper, which I love to do. But the kids aren't doing that either. If you ask, you know, at the risk of being a dinosaur, oh, the kids of today, the kids of today. Of course, we always heard that when we were kids. I think it's true that they're relatively less curious and less informed, and they don't care. And they're playing games and they're texting. And as a segue into our next item, which is on texting while driving, I think that the mindless constant texting and the social networking sites are fine, but it's not that the kids are exactly learning about poetry and Shakespeare and history. Well, now in an interesting new study, it turns out that texting while you drive is worse than almost anything. The researchers said that sending text messages from your mobile phone while driving is more dangerous than climbing behind the wheel under the influence of drink or drugs. The reaction time of people texting fell by 35%, while those who had consumed just the legal limit of alcohol, the minimal legal limit, or had smoked marijuana fell by 21% and 12%. So 35%, your reaction time was down texting. It was down about 20% drinking and 12% by smoking marijuana. So your reaction times texting are three times as bad as somebody who is high on marijuana, which is not great. The researchers said that drivers who text are distracted by taking their hand off the wheel to use their phone, by trying to read small text on the phone display, and by thinking about how to write their message. And as anybody who talks on the phone realizes, that 5 minutes can go by and they haven't really been paying attention. They're sort of aware of the person in front of them, but their mind is elsewhere. Now, it's interesting that in Chicago, They barred cell phone use within the city limits in the car. Anyways, they were talking about barring cell phone use while walking across intersections because some people have gotten hit. And now they're talking about, of course, barring texting. So not only talking on the cell phone, but texting as well. When they surveyed 18 to 24-year-olds, half admitted to texting as they drove. Probably more than half actually text. And the conclusion is that, and this is scary, that people who are legally drunk are actually in better shape driving than texters. Susie, what do you think?
Well, to me it seems like when you're texting, whether you're in a car or not, your head is down and has to stay down and looking at your cell phone to be able to actually do the texting. So if you're driving and you're texting, it makes sense that you are not looking out the window of your car. If somebody's had a few drinks and they're driving, at least they're still looking out the window. They're impaired, but their head is most likely looking out. I think it's terrifying. I don't know if the listeners out there have noticed it, but I've certainly seen it, whether at a stoplight or seeing somebody who's driving and their head is down. Usually you can get the impression or you have a feeling you know what they're doing, and it's just insanity.
Yeah, they've actually done MRI scans. It's called functional MRI, with people talking on the cell phone. I don't know if they've done it texting, but talking on the cell phone, their brain, their attention is way off. It's not anywhere near where it has to be to do something like operate machinery like a car.
So the reasonable question is, why are people doing this while they're driving, whether at a stoplight or as they're merging onto a highway? Is it possible that a lot of people who do this on a regular basis feel that it's just become such a part of their life that they are able to incorporate it or feel that they can incorporate it into their driving as well? Is it like an obsession or an addiction?
I think a lot of people are addicted to their cell phones, and more and younger people, they're addicted to texting, and they can't get away from it, or they get texted from somebody and they want to text back even though they're driving. You know, it comes under distracted driving, whether it's putting on makeup or eating a banana or talking to a passenger and turning around with the kids. It all leads to accidents.
Well, what about that horrific train accident in California recently where it's now been concluded that the engineer of the commuter train or the passenger train had text messaged somebody within 30 seconds of driving his train into an oncoming train. And I believe that there is now a law has already been passed in California that train engineers cannot text while driving a train.
It's interesting legally how the technology works with cell phones and with texting, where they can figure out to the second, of course, when somebody was talking or texting. Now, in another study recently that does involve drugs also, they looked at marijuana and early psychosis like schizophrenia, and a lot of the kids say, well, it's only marijuana, it's only weed, there's no big deal. Now, here researchers from Spain have found a strong and independent link between cannabis use, marijuana use, and the onset of psychosis at a younger age. The association cannot be explained just by chance and is not related to any gender or the use of other drugs. The more cannabis was smoked, the more likely people became psychotic. Now, the only problem that I ever have with studies such as this is the chicken and the egg. Are people who are going to become schizophrenic much more likely to smoke marijuana? The answer is probably they all smoke cigarettes. But the researcher said that estimates of the risk suggest that the use of marijuana accounts for about 10% of cases of psychosis, which is huge. Once somebody becomes schizophrenic or psychotic, it's often a downhill, usually a downhill progressive disease. Now, in the study, they teased out other effects such as gender and other drugs, and linked the increase in psychosis just to marijuana, which is a mild hallucinogen. And the conclusion was that marijuana is not this benign drug that a lot of the kids think it is, that it's can be a dangerous drug if you, particularly if you're genetically inclined to develop schizophrenia or another psychotic problem such as psychotic depression. Now, Susie, you were a social worker with kids and drugs. What do you think about this study?
Well, I obviously, you know, for many kids, many people will say that marijuana is just a natural product from the soil and that there's nothing wrong with using it and it doesn't bring out any harmful characteristics in people. I mean, that's typically what I would usually hear from adolescents in the high school where I worked at. But obviously, looking at the study, it can certainly bring out things. I'm just wondering, and maybe if you could clarify this, this was when people are going to become schizophrenic, obviously it's latent inside of them, and what the marijuana did is just bring out what was already there within some individuals.
They didn't say that in the study, but I think that's true. Many problems are genetic, and then it's this what we call biopsychosocial model. There's environmental influences. So somebody might be born with a genetic tendency towards being a borderline personality disorder, which is bad. But if they have a good childhood, maybe it won't come out. If they have a lot of abuse as a child, maybe it will come out. So maybe if people with a mild tendency or genetically towards schizophrenia don't smoke any marijuana or do PCP or other dangerous drugs like that, it won't come out. Maybe it will if they do. And again, there's the chicken and the egg. If they have a tendency towards that, maybe they're more likely to smoke marijuana. That's possible. But it's funny that I remember 40 years ago, kids were saying the same thing. Marijuana is not dangerous. And the parents would say something like, well, why do you think they call it dope, dope? And now the kids say, well, it's only weed and it's only marijuana. And for a lot of kids, there's no harm. In fact, probably the majority. Majority of kids experiment with marijuana, then they smoke some. Maybe they'll smoke off and on as an adult, but it doesn't rise to an addictive level. But then there's a lot of people where it does harm them. Susie?
Well, I'm thinking of an incident that's recently come up with a friend of mine whose son has been struggling with smoking marijuana. He's in high school. In any event, he's been hanging out with some kids, and it's come to the attention of my friend that some of the kids' parents are basically saying it's okay to smoke it, you know, let's try to do it in moderation, and have actually been smoking it with their children. This has had an effect on my friend's son, where he is now saying, well, Mr. and Mrs. such and such say it's okay. What's wrong with you? Other parents are saying it's okay. You guys are just behind the times. So what I've seen unfold with this situation, I can only say to everybody out there is, you know, you're really doing harm to kids, or kids really need to hear from adults and parents that, hey, you may think this is really okay, but it really isn't okay, because kids really do end up listening to adults whether or not we think they are.
You know, I think that's a great point. We've come a long way with drinking that way. It used to be that parents would say, well, as long as they're in my house, it's okay. I know that they're drinking, but they're safe. Or the parents drank with the kids. And the legal situation is that when kids go out and drink and drive then or die, they sue the parents. This has happened in our community. And then it was always a bad idea to say, oh, it's okay in our house drinking. But we still have parents who feel that it's okay to smoke marijuana, or the parents, a lot of parents smoke marijuana, and they give the impression of the kids. And I don't want to be a Puritan about it, but we're not our kids' best friend. We have to be parents. And the message to them that it's okay to smoke marijuana filters through as it's also okay to do other drugs. A lot of kids take it and later on say, I wish my parents had been tougher or taken a negative stand. Now, another story that came about this week is that Congress passed a mental health bill basically saying that insurance should pay the same for mental health as for other illnesses. And it was always crazy to me that insurance would not pay for depression or anxiety, seeing a therapist or getting on medicine, but they would pay for other medical problems when the psychiatric illnesses, depression, anxiety, bipolar, schizophrenia, cause more disability and more harm than most medical illnesses. It just didn't make any sense not to see that as a medical illness. Of course, insurances are trying to cut costs and keep costs down, and that's part of their job, I guess, but it didn't make any sense. There's a lot of things about our healthcare system that don't make any sense. Insurances will easily pay for a $10,000 procedure that takes an hour, or a technology scan, or a simple surgery, but they won't pay for somebody to listen to somebody. They don't pay for cognitive listening skills by the doctor or for mental health. But now they'll have to pay for psychotherapy and mental health, and I think this is huge. It's going to let a lot more people into therapy, get on antidepressants, et cetera, and we'll see less addiction, less suicide, less depression. It really helps the country in many, many ways. I think economically, too, the biggest drain on our system from physical standpoints, you could say, might be diabetes or asthma, low back pain, migraines, but it's actually probably depression, which dwarfs everything else. It's not that people don't go to work with depression, although many don't, but it's underachievement. They go to work and sort of mill around and don't want to interact with anybody. So anything that gets depression treated is a good thing in my book. Now, along the depression lines, there was a study recently on breast cancer survivors reporting that they feel more fatigue and negative emotions, probably depression, than people who did not have cancer. And even these were people who survived breast cancer who were presumably cancer-free, but they still had negative emotions, depression, and fatigue. The study did conclude that it points out that people with breast cancer and probably other cancers need to consider getting in with psychosocial healthcare workers, psychotherapists, maybe on antidepressants. Interestingly enough, they looked at people who did more as far as activities and exercise, and discovered that no matter how active people were or how long it had been since their breast cancer treatment, the cancer patients reported being less happy and less energetic than the control group. So the conclusion is that even after treatment and people are discharged from therapy or just for follow-up for the breast cancer, that they ought to probably be referred to mental health professionals. Now over to my co-host, Susie, who is also a volunteer in a cancer treatment center. What do you think, Suze?
Well, it's very sad to hear, isn't it, that, you know, once women are healthy again after going through the grueling process of breast cancer, that they would still be going through these emotional feelings. I think one point that probably needs to be made is that for many of these women, once they're told you're cancer-free, your chemotherapy is done, your radiation is done, go and live your life, for many of them there is that fear in the back of their mind that the cancer is going to reemerge and they're going to have recurrent breast cancer. I know this article doesn't mention that, but I've heard it so many times from women, some of them even afraid to leave. They almost feel better knowing they're still in treatment, because at least that way they're still fighting the cancer or any cancer that might be lurking somewhere. So I think your point of seeking some kind of therapy afterwards, and certainly during the treatments as well, would be helpful. But I do think that for many women, they're afraid that they're going to have to come back again.
That's very interesting. And I wonder, there's other conditions where people get depressed, like after heart problems, after a bypass, coronary artery bypass graft, where people have their heart arteries repaired. There's a lot of depression, and people have said that it's physical from the heart-lung machine or the actual surgery, but I think it's It's also that people are worried. Heart patients become a little bit of what we call cardiac cripples, where they're constantly worried and anxious that they're going to have a heart attack naturally. And that leads to the same depression. Suze?
Is it possible that when people go through any type of medical trauma, such as these that we've mentioned, that there's really a loss of innocence in terms of how you feel about your life and how you're going to now look at your life for as long as you have? And that just a reality sets in that, yes, you've made it through, but there is just some sort of loss in dealing with the pain that you've been through in getting healthy again.
Absolutely. I think that it changes your brain chemistry. It's like having a post-traumatic stress disorder type problem where there is certain vulnerability. Some people go through breast cancer treatment or they have heart attacks and they're fine. They never have a day of depression. But most people are affected one way or another. If you're lucky enough to have been born with a lot of serotonin and no depression in the family and great brain chemistry, as I call it, you'll scoot through, but relatively few people are that lucky. Now, speaking of serotonin, there's another serotonin syndrome, irritable bowel syndrome, that a lot of people with headaches, which are primarily serotonin or does involve serotonin, get irritable bowel. Irritable bowel is fairly common. It affects 25 or 30% of the population at some point in their life, and symptoms include chronic abdominal pain or bloating, diarrhea, constipation, reflux, that sort of thing. And in a new study, regular exercise may help the constipation part of irritable bowel. It's another reason to exercise. They took a group of people and put in a brief, pragmatic exercise program and concluded that it led to a significant increase in the amount of IBS patients who felt that their stomach was much better. Irritable bowel people sometimes don't exercise because they're afraid of if they go to a health club, etc., kicking off the abdominal pain. But this study said that just like with other groups, exercise is very helpful. We have medicines that can help irritable bowel with diarrhea. We don't have that much that helps the constipation. Several years ago, there was a drug called Zelnorm that worked on constipation with irritable bowel, and it was taken off the market. And a lot of people are waiting for it to get back on the market because it did help them. We just don't have terrific drugs that reverse the constipation. We have a number of powders, and this powder called Miralax is over-the-counter, and it's pretty good, but the treatments are not ideal. Now, our last item of the day, recently there was a study about antidepressants possibly damaging DNA in men's sperm, and it was about 35 healthy men were given paroxetine, which is Paxil, sold by Glaxo, and they discovered that it may increase somewhat DNA damage in sperm. It's very unclear if this is enough to have any clinical effect, and they didn't look at this. But it does raise the possible side effect of birth defects among people who, fetuses were born where the father had been on antidepressants for any period of time. We really don't know clinically the effects. This was a research type study, and it was a small study. And the bigger issue is we need to treat depression, of course, because all the fallout of depression, such as loss of job and life and suicide, is a problem. But we need to really look at this issue further because there's a lot of young and middle-aged men who have kids who are on antidepressants. Now, there's always pluses and minuses with any drug. The SSRIs, which is the serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Paxil. And this, if the study involves Paxil, probably would be applicable to other SSRIs, although they'd have to be tested. The negatives of these are that they decrease sex drive and libido and ability to have sex anyways. And they can make people spacey or tired or nervous or weight gain. On the other hand, the pluses are helping anxiety and depression, which is crippling, and helping quality of life and decreasing suicide and all that. So it's a case-by-case basis. It has to be weighed. We don't want to just jump into these drugs willy-nilly. But on the other hand, when they're withheld, things like the suicide rate go up a lot. So it's a quandary when you discover that there may be a serious side effect such as men's fertility such as this. Susie, what do you think?
Well, I think it's scary to hear. I mean, because there's a lot of people, a lot of men out there that are taking SSRIs, and to have this thrown into the mix would be really terrifying. What about for women? Are there any? Have there been studies that have come along that have any concerns with women with fertility?
Well, there's been a lot of studies during pregnancy, women on them, and it may lead to on the antidepressants to low birth weight babies, a slight increased chance. But generally, most of the antidepressants have been quasi-safe, not 100% safe during pregnancy.
Well, I'm wondering, because this only women get pregnant, so for the men, it's if they're on the SSRIs prior to women becoming pregnant and then the woman conceiving a child. But for a woman, can this be a concern whether she's trying to get pregnant or not, or taking an SSRI while she is pregnant?
Well, I don't. I know they've probably done some studies on the DNA in eggs of women who've been taking SSRIs, antidepressants, before pregnancy, what it does to the DNA. I'm not aware of what the studies have shown, if they've really been done well. But during pregnancy, they have these, what they call pregnancy registries, where they monitor pregnancies among women on various drugs, such as the antidepressants. And the SSRIs have been relatively safe. There are a few side effects. We try to avoid medicine in the first trimester, if we can, the first 12 weeks, and try to get women off of drugs the last month, if we can, of course. But the other side is depression. Depression itself is interesting. Not only can it lead to serious side effects in somebody's life, but it may affect the fetus and the baby. Depression, the risk of birth defects in women who were depressed during pregnancy, to my knowledge, in some older studies was increased whether they were on antidepressants or not. So depression has to be generally treated, but we want to minimize the drugs, try not to use drugs if we can, and certainly try to avoid them early in the pregnancy if we can. And then postpartum is a big risk for depression coming back out, or even psychotic depression. And if women are off during pregnancy or the last month, we want to start things postpartum. But then we do have the lactation issues with breastfeeding. So it gets complicated. There are several good registries that people can call. There's a national registry for pregnancy and the drugs, and then one for breastfeeding and the drugs that have updated information on every drug. Susie?
Well, I think it just shows there's a lot of hard choices that people have to make for their own mental health, for planning families, and thank goodness there's a lot of professionals out there that can help people with these decisions, because certainly they're not easy.
It's very tough. For instance, say you just deliver your child, but you have to go back on a number of medicines for bipolar depression. Do you want to breastfeed with the positives of breastfeeding, or have to deal with the medicines? And these are tough choices. Some women choose not to breastfeed because they have to go back on two medicines or so for the severe depression. Getting into postpartum depression that's severe, particularly psychotic, is not only terrible for the mother because there's major suicide risk, etc., but terrible for the baby too. So these are tough choices. Well, that'll wrap up this edition of the Dr. Robbins Show. This is Dr. Larry Robbins with my co-host Susie Robbins, and see you next time.